Welcome to the Africa Speaking Podcast. The podcast discusses critical issues about the African continent. It is brought to you by Teresa Communications in Nairobi.
Welcome back to the second part of our four-part series. I'm your host, Maslin Nyambala. We are continuing our important conversation with Dr. Stanley Kibet. Today, we are further examining the integration of scientific and indigenous wisdom to unlock opportunities for climate change adaptation and strengthening community resilience. Let's keep learning. You already have touched on the Ogiek uniquely their relationship. But I know that you have a broad experience having worked with the National Museums and even teaching. From your studies and from your knowledge, what are some of the indigenous cultural conservation efforts that even, not necessarily in Nakuru, but that communities have used towards mitigation, adaptation, and building resilience? And what is the interplay with the scientific knowledge that some of it which you have mentioned, the emerging new approaches? So maybe if you can discuss some of the cultural methods.
First of all, I want to say that the cultural conservation or the cultural practices that communities have done in the past have really proven over time that they stood the test of time. They are actually effective. So how the communities have done in conservation, for example, is that biodiversity, for example. And in this case, when I talk of biodiversity, it could be wildlife, it could be crops, it could be plants in the forest. But I want to give an example of things that are very close to farmers, for example, in Nakuru, things of crops. I can give an example of a crop like njahe, which is a traditional crop.
Yes.
It's a native plant in this country. It has been able to survive for many years because of cultural practices of the Kikuyu community. So that crop has existed, not because there's been so much research that has been saying, now we are promoting the way you do maize and other and beans. But this one has survived courtesy of the culture of the community, that they've used it to feed mothers after giving birth because they believe it has some health benefits. They've been used among the boys during times of circumcision. It's also been used in marriages. So because as long as those cultures continue to live, you'll always have jahe in the menu. And in that alone has made it possible that jahe lives today, even though there's been no serious promotion by any government for that case.
So it is like its relevance and value attached to it.
Yes, because of the value attached to it, it has survived. So what then that means is that jahe has had very little modification because there's been not much science done in terms of breeding and that kind of stuff. And therefore, because of climate change, these are some of the crops that can actually survive they've not been manipulated as much. But during times of climate change, and I said pest and disease outbreaks could be one of the hazards. Crops that have been highly bred, like maize and others, they could easily be wiped out by some fungus or some whatever that could come because of, you know, breeding always select things that you like. And therefore, there are very few, the gene diversity is so small. And therefore, we have crops like njahe are the things that we know for sure that it can survive issues of climate change because of they've not been worked on so much in terms of breeding. So you'd always go back to them. So that is one case of acrobiodiversity that has been retained by culture. It's the same thing with the mastice, which also happens to be Nakuru. You see, many places in Kenya, we don't have wildlife living side by side with communities. But in Maasai area, we're talking about Kajado, Narok, even in Laikipia, there seems to be very high diversity of wildlife. And then you ask yourself, why Maasais and wildlife? Let's say, for example, the elephants. The Maasai community believed that elephant was a girl, a Maasai girl who had been married off. And as the culture of Maasai dictates, when a girl is married off, when you're leaving your father's home to go to your new home, your husband's new home, you're not supposed to look back. So the myths around it say that this girl, she went somewhere in the middle of the road. She looked back and she turned into an elephant.
Okay.
And because of that, the Maasai community believes that is their girl, sister. Their girl. And Maasais will never eat the meat of an elephant like other communities in Kenya do. If an elephant, if a Maasai found a carcass of an elephant, traditionally they put a grass or some twigs or some leaves as a sign of respect. So then the issue is that you see elephants in Maasai land, and it is just part of the ecosystem. Nobody sees elephants as a potential sources of meat. So those myths are existing in many other other animals, and some other things. You see some of the trees where communities pray, like the fig tree. I give you the community like Kikuyus, with all the changes that have happened in the Kikuyu land.
It's a Mugumo.
Mugumo tree?
Yeah.
Yes. There's still a hesitant, there's lingering hesitation for a Kikuyu, whether it's a pastor or a sheikh, to cut the Mugumo tree in his farm. You know, so that is still there, that there's still something about the Mugumo, even though they may have changed in terms of their belief system. And this is also a very good thing that is also, I would talk about the Luhya community, for example, that there's a particular, is a Jugumawe, Bambara nuts. Bambara nuts is also one of the crops they usually consider as neglected crop, probably because it's not been promoted again, like I said, in Jahe.
You call it which nut?
Bambara nuts. Bambara nuts is a crop that is very popular in Western Kenya. There's still some few places here in Nairobi you can find. Jugumawe is among the Luhya community, when the daughter gets married off, among the many things that is put in that basket are the seeds of bambara nuts. And it symbolizes, of course, fertility and other things. But this is a thing that I give you this so that you're fertile. And when you have your own children also, you're supposed to be added over to this. So you have this thing being added over generation after generation after generation. And you may realize that now, because of intermarriages among the Luhyas and the Luos and other people in that region, there's so much bambaranas moving out, because every time you're married to Luo land, you're given bambara nuts for your mom, so you go and Koroi.
So you're saying these have been able to conserve some of the biodiversity in different communities and even across, based on interaction.
That's correct. But the culture of the people, to a large extent, has played a significant role in maintaining biodiversity, which is a big problem now when you're talking of mothers on climate change. So those are the things that communities have done that you're now realizing and say, oh, wait a minute. A lot of the plants that you're saying to be drought resistant, like millet, like sorghum, all those ones are plants that have been maintained by communities for the longest. So we don't have yet, from the science, the a quick fix. Although we are now having things on biotechnology where we are trying to play around with the genetic materials of some plants to have crops that are able to survive with minimal moisture or minimal rain, for crops that will survive with less of chemicals. But as it is right now, that technology is still not yet present with us here. And these are the things that now the science world are saying, oh, wait a minute, I think there is something we can borrow from the traditional knowledge and the culture of the people.
I watched a lady who said, in terms of metrology, that her grandmother was her best weatherman, just by watching how the birds are flying, how the insects are behaving. She could say that it's about to rain, or it's going to rain this evening. Nobody else can tell. And I think you were mentioning how even the traditional can work with some of the modern scientists to be able to respond better, to even alert.
In the recent past, the Kenya Meteorological Departments have decided to work with local communities, and they're doing weather predictions. And the reason for that is that they realize that communities, some of the communities actually trust their own in terms of the predictions, especially among the pastoral communities. Prediction is always going on there. and a lot of commonest one I know among the people like the Maasais, the Pokots, the Borana, the Samburu, is where they slaughter a goat or a cow and they're able to read the intestines and they can actually tell something about weather.
The intestines of a cow?
Or a goat.
Oh.
So they open the intestines and then there's the people who are experts, they can actually read and they're not only predicting about weather, but also other things as well. Oh. Like if there is any things that are not good for the community, it could be drought, it could be some diseases, it could be some war,
yes,
or an outbreak of war with the neighboring communities. So those things are there. And in the recent past, working with NDMA, National Drought Management Authority, that has become something that has been adopted lately now, that when the weathermans are doing their predictions, they also ask them, you guys do your things and let's compare them.
They ask communities.
Communities, yes. Mm-hmm. So they have now communities doing their own predictions. And I can tell you that there's been a lot of similarities in the outcomes. The most recent one, I was in Baringo late last year, and the prediction that they had said that the short rain was going to fail, and it failed again.
Oh, in Baringo?
There's still no rain. So they say there's going to be rain, but very little.
Yes.
And actually, the only rain areas, the higher areas like Barnet, but down in Tiati, there was nothing.
By communities. And
so what the NDMA usually do is that they bring, because they have some experts that are known now in the community to do that predictions. So they facilitate them.
And now, how frequently do they meet? What are the modalities?
What I know for sure is that occasionally the NDMA have facilitated communities to do the predictions. In counties like in Baringo, where there are several communities, they would ask the various experts from those different communities. They would slaughter a goat, and then they'll call individually separately. So they would come, and then one would read and goes away. Another one comes, does the same. Another one comes like that.
Oh.
But sometimes they've also done all of it together. So they go to the same place and they all read, and then they say, do you agree with this? I can see it's going to be some rain. I can see there's going to be a lot of flooding, that kind of stuff. It's really very amazing.
Yes, amazing. So that means that the government has now recognized.
Yes. Actually, that is a more important thing than now, because of that, the science is also recognizing that it has some limitation and they can borrow from other knowledges. And this is an amazing opportunity, because for the longest, the indigenous knowledge has been seen to be backward, it's not belonged to the 21st century. But with the climate change and other challenges that people are having right now, there is now this thinking like, wait a minute, we've got to see, we're not getting it right. There could be some other things that you can learn. But another important thing is that because you want the communities themselves to do certain things, then you need to talk the language of the community.
Yeah.
If they believe in the traditional prediction, the ones who predict the rain from the communities, then no matter how much government will say, they may not even listen.
Yeah.
So that is why now having them linking the scientific knowledge and the community knowledge will be very useful, so that you also increase the community's participation in that decision. That we need to move, especially among the pastoral community, that there's going to be drought in this area. What do we need to do? Maybe we destock, have few livestock,
okay,
for example.
So they're able to do interventions.
Or we need to buy pastures and stock them so that the animals don't die. And maybe county government may decide to bring bosses for water. But also more importantly, that during times of water and pasture scarcity, there's also a lot of conflicts with the communities, especially pastoral communities, where they concentrate on areas where there's some pastures and water. And resource-based conflicts become even violent. So what then happens is, because of that, the government is also able to go to those areas. I would give you an example. There's a place in the boundary between Samburu and Isholo. It's called Kom. So it's a floodplain. So it tends to dry the last. When everywhere else is so dry, that place, because it's a floodplain, it remains green for the longest time.
Yeah.
And therefore, all the communities in Northern Earth, the Borana, the Samburu, the Rendile, they will converge there.
Mm.
And what happens is that then the government would send some security people there so that they make sure that they will all be there, but then they will be different. They will be grazing a different side. When the watering point, this group will come today, the next group come the following day, so that they don't fight.
They don't fight.
So those are the things that the predictions help them in preparation.
Mm.
And so the science now is increasingly seeing the role of indigenous knowledge in addressing real challenges that our communities are facing.
Okay.
So it's getting the respect that it deserves, unlike what it was before. And also, as I said, unlike before 2016, there was no law.
Yeah.
But with the promulgation of the enactment of that policy, the Act on traditional knowledge and cultural expression, now it has become, there's now a law to support that. The regulations is the one which is yet to be done to actualize it. The county governments who are now the people in charge of implementing it, there's nothing that can prevent them from going ahead and doing some things in the meantime, even though there is no regulation, because the National Museums of Kenya is spearheading a national program which is supposed to be done in all the 47 counties, is documenting it, because the biggest challenge is, first of all, documenting that knowledge before it disappears, because it is held in people's mind. It's tacit knowledge.
Okay.
So if the elderly people will go away, of course they passed on, they go with the knowledge. So there's really a risk of that losing knowledge. It.
Yes. Yeah.
Also, so now, one of the things that could be done even before the regulations can be put into place is to start doing the documentation, and that's what the museum has been doing. So far, in the first phase, they've done documentation in 13 counties, and the plan is to have all the 47 counties document. So the communities, the counties can already do that. If they can have some resources, they can already document different indigenous knowledge, be it in traditional medicine, traditional food, traditional technologies, music and dance, sacred sites and heritage. Because protecting some of those, documenting those, the importance of some of those places can also provide impetus for their conservation and even allocating resources to them.
Yeah.
But if you don't know about them, then they never put any resources on it. So there is really need to start doing some things about indigenous knowledge, because being passed on by word of mouth, and there's a little that has been documented in some of the things.
Yeah.
It's really critical to start documenting it. So that's what I'm just saying, that the cultural conservation and how it's responding to climate change issues that you have now, and what it pertains even to going forward in building resilience.
Yeah.
You can already see those ones from agrobiodiversity conservation, even wildlife. You talk about now the wildlife among the Maasai community.
Yes.
Wildlife, tourism is one of the biggest income.
Yes.
This country. And everybody just want to say, oh, we want to go to Masai Mara. We want to go to Amboseli.
Yes.
Why not? They're going to another place.
Yeah.
They're going there because there's wildlife.
There's wildlife.
And the wildlife still exists there because of the culture of the people.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's already a very direct link. And also provides people for opportunities for diversification of livelihoods.
Mm.
Because that's also one way of building resilience.
Yeah.
You know, if communities rely on one particular source of livelihood, they really stand a very big risk because of the climate change.
Yes.
Like if you just survive on some crops, and then now they have a big problem with the climate change.
Yeah.
That can be a big problem.
Big problem.
Yeah. So those cultural conservation gives communities opportunities for diversification of livelihoods.
Mm.
That's the real point. And the most important thing is that you have those chances. You could see what happened during the COVID-19.
Yeah.
Very strange, you know, because here as you could not travel outside for medication and everything, all of a sudden everybody became herbalist.
Yeah.
Oh, you need to buy garlic, you need to buy lemons, you need to buy all this. So inherently, we know these things.
Inherently, yeah. What are the alternatives?
Yeah. So that's why I think culture has really given us an opportunity to build resilience for communities.
That brings us to the end of the second part of our series with Dr. Stanley Kibet. Join me, Maslin Nyambala, for the third part next time as we delve deeper.
Thank you for listening to the Africa Speaking Podcast. Join us in our next episode brought to you by Twiza Communications in partnership with Forum Sieve. For any comments and views, you can reach us through our website, www.africaspeaking.org. You can also reach us on Facebook, Twiza Communications, or on our X handle, @TwizaComs. You can also write to us on email, info@africaspeaking.org.